Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, theology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth. And when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evidence Footprint, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this May the 21st on the West Coast, now May the 22nd on the East Coast, and in the Central Time Zone. It's nice to have you with us this evening. I'm going to do a solo show tonight, and I did have a guest scheduled, but she was unable to make it this evening, and hopefully we'll have her on in the future. In the meantime, with everything that's going on, I thought it might be worthwhile to talk about the issue of the law and what we're not told about the nature of the law. And I think you'll find this show very interesting. Certainly you'll want to refer back to the archive. I'm actually going to read something tonight. I don't often do that. Yet I feel that this is an important document, and it appears to be true, we'll say. The author is unknown, and yet it's a compilation of different work, and it's called The A Lawyer's Secret Oath, an expose on the legal fraud perpetrated on all Americans. This is edited, altered, enhanced significantly from audio tape by a private, non-resident, non-domestic, non-person, non-individual, pursuant to, and real or imaginary statutory regulations. That is the specificity of who that person is. The name really doesn't even apply, and that's the whole point, why the person didn't put the name. And we're going to get into that now. I will be taking calls probably on the half hour. So if after I've shared some or most of this document with you, it's about 16 pages long. I'm interested in hearing from the listening audience on your thoughts about this particular document. All right, lawyer's secret oath. Let's get right to the point. The courts recognize only two classes of people in the United States today: debtors and creditors. The concept and status of debtors and creditors is very important for you to understand. Every legal action where you are brought before the court, example given, a traffic ticket, property dispute or permits, income tax, credit cards, bank loans, or anything else they might dream up to charge you where you find yourself in front of a court. It is an equity court administrating commercial law, having a debtor-creditor law as the controlling law. Today we have an equity court, but not an equity court as referred to in the Constitution of the U.S. or any of the legal documents before 1938. All the courts of this once great land have been changed, starting with the Supreme Court decision of 1938 in Erie versus Tompkins. I'll give you background which led to this decision. Some of this information is from the Ben Freeman tapes of 1989. They are excellent tapes if you have them. Ben used to talk about legislative democracy. I couldn't find a definition for legislative democracy. It bothered me. However, by listening to his tapes as well as other tapes, I began to see the fraud that is being perpetrated on all of us Americans. Please understand that this fraud is 24 hours, 7 days a week, year after year, continuous fraud. It doesn't just happen once in a while. This fraud is constantly upon you all your life. Whether you are aware of it or not, this fraud is perpetually and incessantly upon you and your family. U.S. Inc. goes to Geneva, 1930s. In order for you to understand just how this fraud works, you need to know the history of its inception. It goes like this. From 1928 to 1932, there were 5 years of Geneva Conventions. The nations of the world met in Geneva, Switzerland for 5 continuous years in order to set up what would be the policy of all the participating countries. During the year of 1938, the U.S., Great Britain, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, Portugal, etc., all declared bankruptcy. If you try to look up the 1938 minutes, you will not find them because they don't publish this particular volume. If you try to find the 1938 volume which contains the minutes of what happened, you will probably not find it. This volume has been pulled out of circulation or is hidden in the library and is very hard to find. This volume contains the evidence of the bankruptcy. Going into 1932, they stopped meeting in Geneva. In 1932, Franklin Roosevelt came into power as President of the United States. Roosevelt's job was to put into place and administer the bankruptcy that had been declared 2 years earlier. The corporate government needed a key Supreme Court decision. The corporate United States government had to have a legal case on the books to set the stage for recognizing, implementing, and supporting the bankruptcy. Now, this doesn't mean the bankruptcy wasn't implemented before 1938 with the Erie versus Tompkins decision. The bankruptcy started in 1930 to 31. The bankruptcy definitely started when Roosevelt came into office. He was sworn in during the month of January 1933. He started right away in the bankruptcy with what is known as the banking holiday and proceeded in pulling the gold coin out of circulation. That was the beginning of the corporate United States public policy for bankruptcy. Roosevelt stacks Supreme Court. It is a known historical fact that during 1933 and from 1937 to 1938, there was a big fight between Roosevelt and the Supreme Court justices. Roosevelt tried to stack the Supreme Court with a bunch of his pals. Roosevelt tried to enlarge the number of justices, and he tried to change the slant of the justices. The corporate United States had to have one Supreme Court case which would support their bankruptcy problem. There was resistance to Roosevelt's court stacking efforts. Some of the justices tried to warn us that Roosevelt was tampering with the law and with the courts. Roosevelt was trying to see to it that prior decisions of the court were overturned. He was trying to bring in a new order, a new procedure for the law of the land. The mother corporation goes bankrupt. A bankruptcy case was needed on the books to legitimize the fact that the corporate U.S. had already declared bankruptcy. This bankruptcy was effectuated by compact that the corporate several states had with the corporate government, corporate capital of these several corporate states. This compact tied the corporate several states to corporate Washington, D.C., the headquarters of the corporation called the United States. Since the United States Corporation, having established its headquarters within the District of Columbia, declared itself to be in the state of bankruptcy, it automatically declared bankruptcy for all its subsidiaries who were effectually connected corporate members, who happened to be the corporate state governments of the Union. The corporate state governments didn't have to vote on the bankruptcy. The bankruptcy automatically became effective by reason the compact agreement between each of the corporate state governments and the mother corporation. She has for her trade names the following: United States, U.S., USA, United States of America, Washington, D.C., District of Columbia, Feds, federal government. She has her own U.S. Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Parks, Post Office, etc., etc., etc. Because she is claiming to be bankrupt, she freely gives her land, her personnel, and the money she steals from the Americans via the IRS and her state corporations to the United Nations and the international banksters as payment for her debt. The UN and the international banksters use this money and services for various worldwide projects to include war. War is an extremely lucrative business for the bankers of the New World Order. Loans for destruction, loans for reconstruction, loans for controlling people on her world property. U.S. Incorporated declares bankruptcy. The corporate U.S. then is the head corporate member who met at Geneva to decide for all its corporate body members. The corporate representatives of corporate several states were not in attendance. If the states had their own power to declare bankruptcy, regardless of whether Washington, D.C. declared bankruptcy or not, then the several states would have been represented at Geneva. The several states of America were not represented. Consequently, whatever Washington, D.C. agreed to at Geneva was passed on automatically via compact to the several corporate states as a group, association, corporation, or as a club member. They all agreed and declared bankruptcy as one government corporate group in 1938. The several states only needed a representative at Geneva by way of the U.S. in Washington, D.C. The delegates of the corporate United States attended the meetings and spoke for the several corporate states as well as for the mother corporation located in Washington, D.C., the seat and headquarters of the federal corporate government. And presto, bankruptcy was declared for all. From 1930 to 1938, the states could not enact any law or decide any case that would go against the federal government. The case had to come down from the federal level so that the states could then rely on the federal decision and use this decision within the states as justification for the bankruptcy process within the states. Uniform Commercial Code emerges as law of land. By 1938, the corporate federal government had the true bankruptcy case they had been looking for. Now, the bankruptcy that had been declared back in 1938 could be upheld and administered. That's why the Supreme Court had to be stacked and made corrupt from within. The new players on the Supreme Court fully understood that they had to destroy all other case law that had been established prior to 1938. The federal government had to have a case to destroy all precedents, all appearance, and even the statute of law itself. That is, the statutes at large had to be perverted. They finally got their case in Erie versus Tompkins. It was right after that case that the American Law Institute and the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, listed right in front of the Uniform Commercial Code, began creating the Uniform Commercial Code that is on our backs today. Let us quote directly from preface of the 1990 official text of the Uniform Commercial Code, 12th edition. Quote, the code was originally approved by its sponsors and the American Bar Association in 1952 and was released in 1958 to incorporate a number of changes that had been recommended by the New York Law Revision Commission and other agencies. Subsequent amendments that were deemed desirable in light of experience under the code were approved by the Permanent Editorial Board in 1962 and 1966. The above-named groups and associations of private lawyers got together and started working on the Uniform Commercial Code, otherwise known as the UCC. It was somewhere between 1938 and 40, I don't recall, but by the early 40s and during the war, this committee was working to form the UCC and got it ready to put on the market. The UCC is the Law Merchant's Code for the administration of the bankruptcy. The UCC is now the new law of the land as far as the courts are concerned. This legal committee of lawyers put everything, negotiable instruments, security, sales, contracts, and the whole mess under the UCC. That's where the uniform word comes from. It means it was uniform from state to state, as well as being uniform with the District of Columbia. It doesn't mean you didn't have the uniform instrument laws on the books before this time. It means the laws were not uniform from state to state. By the middle 1960s, every state had passed the UCC into law. The states had no choice but to adopt newly formed Uniform Commercial Code as the law of the land. The states fully understood they had to administrate bankruptcy. Washington, D.C. adopted the Uniform Commercial Code in 1963, just 6 weeks or so after Kennedy was killed. Your lawyer's secret oath? What was the effect and the significance of the Erie versus Tompkins case decision of 1938? The significance is that since the Erie decision, no cases are allowed to be cited that are prior to 1939. There can be no mixing of the old law with the new law. The lawyers, who are members of the American Bar Association, were and are currently under and controlled by the Lawyers Guild of Great Britain, created, formed, and implemented the new bankruptcy law. The American Bar Association is a franchise of the Lawyers Guild of Great Britain. Since the Erie versus Tompkins case was decided, the practice of law in this country was never again to be the same. It has been reported, source unknown to writer, that every lawyer in existence and every lawyer coming up has to take a secret oath to support the bankruptcy. This seems to make sense after you read about Mr. Sweet's case file disappear, discussed later in this report. There is more to it. Not only do they promise to support the bankruptcy, but the lawyers and judges also promise never to reveal who the true creditor party is in the bankruptcy proceedings. In court, there is never identification and appearance of the true character and principal of the proceedings. This is where you can get them for not making an appearance in court. If there is no appearance of the true party to the action, then there is no way the defendant is able to know the true nature and the cause of the action. You are never told the true nature and the cause of why you are in front of their court. The court is forbidden to tell you that information. That's why, if you question the true nature and cause, the judge will say, "It's not my job to tell you. You are not retaining me as an attorney, and I can't give you legal advice from the bench. I suggest you hire a lawyer." Hire a lawyer? The problem here is, if you hire a lawyer who is pledged not to reveal the true nature and the cause, how will you ever find out the true nature and the cause? You won't. Why? If the true nature and cause of the action against you is revealed, it will expose the real creditor from whom this action and cause came. In other words, they will have to name the true creditor. The true creditor will have to state the nature and the cause. The true creditor will have to say, "It's a bankruptcy proceeding." The true creditor would have to say, "I'm the creditor and he's the debtor." That declaration then opens the door for you to question, "Who the hell are you? How did you get attached to my back, and by what vehicle did I promise to become a debtor to you?" In this country, the courts on every level, from the justice of the peace level all the way up, even into the international law arena called the World Court, are administrating the bankruptcy and are pledged not to reveal who the true creditors really are and how you personally became pledged as a party or participant to the corporate United States debt. What would really kill these people off would be to compel the international bankers to send a lawyer to the courtroom and present himself as the attorney for the true creditor, the international banksters. Then have the attorney to put into the record the true nature and cause of the proceedings against you on that particular day. The international banksters told these various countries that they were now in a state of bankruptcy. The countries had been taken over by the creditor bankers, and there was no choice but for all these participating countries to declare bankruptcy. If they didn't agree to declare bankruptcies, the banksters threatened to collapse the economies and thereby put the countries back into the depression like the one from which they were just emerging. The banksters made an offer they couldn't refuse. Now, ponder that for a moment. This is an unquote. Ponder this for a moment, because we're in exactly the same situation today, if you think about it. To review and elaborate, in 1930, there was a worldwide depression. The banker said, look, you can do it either of two ways, the easy way or the hard way. You just accept the bankruptcy and we'll let you out of the depression. If you don't, you're on your own. So all the countries involved agreed because they realized that the international bankers had them by the throat. The countries therefore agreed that over a period of several years, they would pass statutes and legislation for the implantation of the bankruptcy in favor of the international banksters. Now, I would say that the key banksters were Rothschild and family and their agents by way of Rockefeller, by way of the Federal Reserve banksters. Who were more involved as key banksters and their agents is pure conjecture on my part, but it really doesn't matter at this point. The point is there was an international bankruptcy and an international conspiracy to cover it up. There was a banking creditor who made the offer. The countries accepted the offer in order to enable the representative countries to continue without revolution and to allow the politicians to remain comfortably in place. Under a delusion of solvency, the countries were allowed to continue to operate as though they were solvent, while in fact the representative countries were bankrupt. The snare. The bankruptcy scheme was or is an extremely clever and diabolical plan. How do they possibly pull the scheme off in the area of real estate? The bankers did it with real estate the same way they did it in the area of federal income taxes. These foreign banksters simply and deceptively devised ways and means to con you into declaring yourself as a citizen or a resident of the corporate U.S. Remember, the corporate United States is bankrupt per agreement and public policy. After you have been tricked into claiming you are one of their corporate United States citizens, you are given a Social Security number, which ties you to certain meager benefits and privileges. Then, the banksters con your employer to function as an unpaid taxes collector, to con you into filling out their W-4 intangible property gift forms and 1840 voluntary agreements. These slick paper agreements establish your voluntary indebtedness to the bankster creditor. If at any time you decide to balk at this scheme because you don't like it, the real creditor never has to make an appearance in court to list the true nature and cause of the actions which is being brought against you. You end up dealing with an agency. The agency can conveniently grant itself immunity from prosecution because all it is doing, without your knowledge, of course, is administrating the bankruptcy which the government agreed per the Geneva meetings. The court system never lets you put the original creditor on the courtroom stand so you can ask him how he got attached to your back. The system is set up in such a way that the true creditor is protected and never has to make an appearance and never has to answer any of your questions or produce documents. Therefore, the true creditor never has to produce the law that gives him the right to pledge you, your body and labor, into indebtedness, bondage, servitude. Why? The Geneva Agreement in 1930 was done by treaty. The bankruptcy was not done by legislation. The agreement came first, signed in secrecy. Then Congress began to pass legislation to fulfill the bankruptcy obligation required by the treaty. Legislation being passed by Congress was henceforth and is thereby bankruptcy legislation. When cases came before the courts could then make decisions based on the new controlling law of bankruptcy. It had nothing to do with the constitutional rights. Now, any case brought in is under the new bankruptcy law and is not considered as a true constitutional case. It is now a bankruptcy case as distinct from but cleverly disguised as a constitutional case. The fraud. The members of the Supreme Court, of course, realized what was happening to them and the system of law. The court was being asked to perform in a creditor-debtor bankrupt proceeding to the benefit of the banker, or actually to say bankster, creditors. The members of the Supreme Court said, no, we will not give you a bankrupt proceeding decision that you can then enforce against everybody, a decision not only affecting corporate Washington, D.C., but also government of corporate Washington. But also having effect within the corporate state governments. This, by the way, is fraud. It wouldn't be fraud if the government of corporate Washington, D.C. and the government of the several corporate states declared bankruptcy, then let the people know about the bankruptcy. Notice, when I say corporate government, I don't mean you and me. You and I are not the corporate government. The corporate government is the corporate capital of the corporate state. The government is a neutral government zone known as the corporate capital of the corporate state. The government is where the corporate state is. It is corporate headquarters, just like corporate Washington, D.C. is the seat of the corporate federal government. The capital of the corporate state is the seat of the corporate state government. If the corporate federal government and her subsidiary corporate state government want to join forces and declare bankruptcy, that's not fraud. This is their corporate business. However, it is fraud when those two corporate entities declare bankruptcy but do not disclose to you, me, and every other American that they have so declared bankruptcy. Further, they have not and do not disclose that their intention is to get you and every other American in this country to pledge to pay off their corporate debt to their corporate creditors. The corporate bankruptcy is the corporate state and federal responsibility, not the responsibility of Americans, the people. U.S. Inc. is distinct and separate from private Americans. And when I say U.S. Inc., that's incorporated. We, the people who created and signed the contract, compact, agreement, charter of, by, and for the Constitutional Corporation, U.S., using the trade name of the United States of America, is a corporate entity, legal fiction, which is distinct and separate from Americans or the unenfranchised people of America. The private, natural American people did not create the Corporation of the United States. The United States Incorporated did not create the private, natural American people. America and Americans were in existence prior to the creation of the United States Corporation. The United States Corporation has located its headquarters in Washington, D.C., period. Virginia state territory, gave land to the newly formed United States Corporation. Notice here we have a state giving something of value, land, to the United States. The United States Corporation agreed in the constitutional contract to protect the states. Instead, because of their bankruptcy, corporate U.S. bankruptcy, this particular U.S. corporation has enslaved the states and the people by deception and at the will of their foreign banksters with whom they have been doing business. Our forefathers gave their lives and property to prevent enslavement. Today, we are again enslaved. Private natural American people have been tricked, deceived, and set up to carry the U.S. Incorporated perpetual corporate debt under bankruptcy laws. Every time Americans appear in court, the corporate U.S. bankruptcy is being administrated against them without their knowledge and lawful consent. This is fraud. If corporate bankruptcy administration is done by public policy of, by, and for the mother corporation, U.S. Incorporated. The mother corporation's public policy. The corporate bankruptcy is carried out under the corporate public policy of the corporate federal government in corporate Washington, D.C. The states use state public policy to carry out federal public policy of Washington, D.C. Public policy and only public policy is being administered against you in the corporate courts today. The public policy that is dictated by all the courts, from the smallest to the most powerful courts in the world, is public policy. This is why I said in another tape that the Russian people would be enslaved into indebtedness. What will happen is that it will become public policy in Russia to have the people go into joint corporate debt. The Russians will be forced to promise to pay those debts. They will be forced to pay off on those corporate debts. Corporate public policy is the crux of the whole bankruptcy implementation. Corporate public policy is forever a corporate public policy, and the laws that have been passed since 1938 are all corporate public policy laws dealing only with the corporate public policy. Understand that U.S. corporate public policy is not an American public policy. The public policy is of, belonging to, the United States Corporation. This U.S. corporate bankruptcy public policy is not of, belonging to, America, the Republic. The Erie versus Tompkins 1938 case was a decision based upon public policy. All decisions at any level since 1938 have been public policy decisions. All statutes, rules, regulations, and procedures that have been passed, whether civil or criminal, whether it is federal or state, have all been passed to implement the public policy of bankruptcy. Since 1933, when FDR came into office, he brought in public policy. He established that it was the public policy of the government to call in all the gold. It was the public policy of the government to declare a banking holiday. It was the public policy of the government in Washington, D.C., the federal government, to give out government assistance. Public policy operates the same within the states. All federal court decisions can only be handed down if the states support federal public policy. The state legal system must be compatible with the federal legal system. The monkey wrench. This is why when people like us go to court without being represented by a lawyer, we throw a monkey wrench into their corporate administrative proceedings. Why? Because all public policy corporate lawyers are pledged to hold up public policy, which is the corporate U.S. administration of their corporate bankruptcy. That's why you'll find stamped on many, if not all, our briefs, this case is not to be cited in any other case and is not to be reported in any courts. The reason for this notation is that when we go in to defend ourselves or file a claim, we're not supporting the corporate bankruptcy administration and procedure. The arguments we put forth predate 1938. We come in with constitutional law, etc. All these early cases support our rights not to be in bankruptcy. However, the corporate court, lawyers, and judges have promised to give no judicial recognition of any case before 1938. The International Banksters Corporate Plantation, USA style. Before 1938, the law was not a public policy law. All these old cases were not public law deciding cases. Today, the cases are all decided under corporate public policy. The public policy exists in order to administer the bankruptcy for the benefit of the bankster creditors and to protect the bankster creditor. Corporate public policy can allow the creditor to say to the corporate legislatures, I want a law passed requiring my debtors to wear seat belts. Why? Because I want to be able to milk my debtors for the longest period possible. It doesn't behoove the creditor if all of his debtors die at an average age of 38 years. What would happen to the bankster's lending, interest, penalties, increase, repayment, etc., on the entire funding and lending process if the average American lifespan was only 38 years? Why, the bankers would have to have 2.5 times the current consumer population to equal their current take. The banksters would need, instead of 250 million Americans, 600 million or even more. Maybe the banksters would need 2 billion Americans because the individual can't contract for debt until he or she is 18 or 21 years of age. Therefore, if the average lifespan is only a 38 period, the creditor could collect on the debt for only 12 years. Now, if the banksters can get people to live an average of 78 years, you are talking a whopping 58 years of indebtedness for which they contract and for which they are forced to pay back with usury interest. With this situation, the bankster creditor can now float loans worth 58 years of potential indebtedness and its payoff with interest in the name of the people as opposed to 9 to 12 years. The creditors and their property and their people are well taken care of. The creditor doesn't want the population to decrease per se unless it is convenient for the debtor to run up debts in another's name and then liquidate that debtor or that group of debtor people. For example, let's consider the AIDS problem today among the blacks. What better group to inject AIDS into the black people? Read this. The Strecker Memorandum on AIDS and the World Health Organization connection. This documents their tainted vaccination program in Africa and elsewhere. Why not kill them off? Don't you understand that the blacks as a whole have absorbed all the debt that they can? The blacks have reached the mast of the debt that they can carry. In fact, they have gone over their limit to pay back. They are now heavily into welfare, public housing, Medicaid, Medicare, food stamps, etc. Now, the situation is that instead of paying off the creditor, they have become a drain on the creditor. The creditor must now pay them to live and take care of them. What creditor in his right mind wants to spend money on a bunch of people from whom he can't collect any revenue? The corporate public policy of the corporate United States and the county and of the cities are that you must take care of these people. You must provide them with welfare, etc. Why? Because when you, as a member of the corporate body politic, allows laws to be passed which say that the minorities must be taken care of, then the corporate legislature can say the public policy is that the people want these people taken care of. Therefore, when given the chance, the legislature can say the public policy is that the people want these blacks and poor whites to be taken care of and given a chance. Therefore, we must raise taxes to fund all these benefits, privileges, and opportunities. This is what these people need to make them socially, politically, and economically equal with everyone else. The legislatures have passed all kinds of statutes providing for huge indebtedness, and they float the indebtedness off your backs because you have never gone in to challenge them, telling them that it is not your public policy to assume the debts of other people. On the contrary, all the court decisions coming out indicate it is the corporate public policy, and it is your willingness to support the corporate public policy to pay off these debts. Remember, public means of and for the corporate government. It does not mean of and for private people. Public means corporate government. It is corporate government policy. When they talk about public debt, they are talking about corporate government debt and your presumed pledge against this corporate created debt. The real estate snare. How do they work this scheme in the area of real estate? These bankster creeps have made an agreement that it is corporate public policy that all land or property be pledged to the creditor to satisfy the debt of the bankruptcy, which the creditor claims under bankruptcy. They get away with this the same way they get away with any other case that is brought before the court, whether it is a traffic ticket, IRS, or whatever. Here is how it works. You have signed instruments giving information and jurisdiction to the banksters through their agents. The instruments or forms you signed include, but are not limited to the following. Social Security registration, use of the Social Security number, IRS forms, driver license, traffic citation, jury duty, voter registration, registration using their address, zip code, U.S. Postal Service, a deed, a mortgage application, etc., etc. The banksters then use that instrument or document under the Uniform Commercial Code as a contract or agreement. These documents are considered a promissory contract when you promise to perform. This scheme involves you without you ever becoming directly in contact or in contact with the true creditor. What's more, you are never informed as to whom that true creditor is, and it is never divulged to you the true nature and the true cause of the paperwork that you are filling out. If you will examine your real estate deed, you will find that you promise to pay taxes to the corporate government. On property you originally acquired through a mortgage, you will notice that the bank never promised to pay taxes. You did. The corporate government at all levels never promised to pay taxes to the creditor. You did. In taxes and collection problems relating to real estate being enforced against you, you will notice that there is no mention in the mortgage or the deed stating the true nature and cause of the action. Since you have made the promise to perform, you get a bill every year for property taxes. You don't realize that the only way they can bill you for taxes is through your own stupidity of agreeing to pay the tax. You volunteered. They took advantage of you, conning you to promise to pay property taxes. When they send you their bill, they are coming against you for the collection of the promise you made to the creditor. Now the creditor on the paperwork appears, that is, the local bank. The bank has loaned you credit. The bank hasn't loaned you anything. It was not their credit to loan. This is why the bank can't loan credit. There is a credit involved, but not the bank's credit. It is the credit of the international banksters. The international banksters are making you the loan based upon their operation of bankruptcy claim, which they presume to have against you personally as well as your property. Now, let's say you get the tax bill and you decide, I'm not going to pay it. You will find that the courts and the lawyers and the county agencies are set up to protect the true creditor simply by not identifying the creditor. By not being identified as the true creditor, the international bankster can make you a credit loan that has no value in reality. In the case of real property, he claims to loan you the use of your own property for which you pay a tax as rent. He is allowed to do this because you are presumed by statutory law and the bankster to be in bankruptcy. This fraud is not revealed because he does not have to make an appearance in court to present and defend his claim. His name is not mentioned in the case. Let's say you are not aware of your remedies provided for you within the Uniform Commercial Code. The Uniform Commercial Code provided or allows you to dishonor the county's representment of the tax bill. You don't pay your tax bill. You, therefore, just sit on it and don't do or say anything. A couple of years go by, and all of a sudden you are being sent letters to pay up what is owed, or else in a certain period of time, your property will be taken from you and put up for tax sale. Now, here is what is interesting. If you don't pay your tax bill, and they contact you asking you to pay it, and you don't do it, they will declare that you are in default. It is based on that default, as provided for in the Uniform Commercial Code, that they sell your property for the tax or the rent. However, the county never goes into court to put into the record the identification of the real creditor, and the county does not state the true nature and cause of the action against you. Bankruptcy action disguised as a tax action. Why? Because under bankruptcy implementation, they have developed a legal procedure which is based upon your promise to pay. This procedure provides that they don't have to come to the court to get a court order authorizing the sale of your property. Therefore, the real creditor never makes an appearance in court. The reality is, you are denied any possibility of appearing in court to exercise your right to challenge the creditor, to ask if he became the creditor under public policy, to ask if it is under public policy, just what is the public policy, and How did you, as an international banker, become creditor to me and everyone else in this country, the American people? They don't want you to ask the real creditor, the international banksters, to produce the documents upon which your personal debt is established. If they were forced to go into court, they would have to produce the deed or mortgage showing you knowingly, willingly, and voluntarily promised to pay the corporate public debt. You did not knowingly, willingly, and voluntarily promise to pay any U.S. corporate bankruptcy obligation made in the 1930s. This would, of course, expose their racket. The fact is that there was absolutely no debt connected to you until you agreed to it through their deception and fraud. The deception, in a broader sense, permeates the education system and the new media, etc., to sell you on the idea that you are a statutory U.S. citizen and resident of the United States. And that is the incorporated version of the United States. Your signature is your most valuable property. Your property is pledged for the rest of your life upon your signature, and your promise to perform is pledged into perpetual debt. The banksters don't even bother to go to court. They leave it up to the agencies to administer the agency corporate public policy. It is the public policy of that agency to bill you on your promise to perform. If you don't pay, they follow up on the public policy on notice of default and give you one or more chances to pay. Then they, give you one more chance to pay. Then they proceed to sell the property at a tax auction. They never go to court or appear in court to back up their claim against you. Did any of your government licensed and controlled teachers ever stress that your signature is your most valuable personal property? Did your government teachers ever tell you that any time you sign any document, you should sign it without prejudice or with all rights reserved above your signature? This means you are reserving your God-given, unalienable rights, rights which cannot be transferred, and all other rights for which your forefathers died. The corporate U.S. government provides for this reservation of rights under the Uniform Commercial Code 1-287 and 1-103. You need more information in this area. It is not in the best interest of the United States corporate public schools to teach you about their bankruptcy proceedings. The corporate public schools are strictly designed for their corporate citizens. That is, the corporate U.S. public school citizens. All their students and teachers are trained to produce labor and material in exchange for valueless green paper called money. It is not money, it functions as money. Lawful money must be backed by something of value. Banksters take your labor, services, and material, homes, cars, farms, etc., in exchange for their valueless corporate paper. This paper is backed only by the full faith and confidence of the United States government, the mother corporation. I do not have faith of confidence in the U.S. bankrupt corporate government administrators who have perverted their constitutional charter, ensnaring the sovereign American people into their bankruptcy obligations. Their fraudulent money laundering process promotes your payment on the corporate bankruptcy obligations. This debt is mathematically impossible to pay off. You and your family are in a continual financial bondage to the international banksters. They love it so. Black's Law Dictionary 1990 defines money changers as business of a banker, today handled by the international departments. I got to change page here, pardon me for a second, of banks. Let me think for a moment, what did Christ do to the money changers? Oh yes, he severely interfered with their activity. 3 days later, Christ was crucified. Lincoln was killed for interfering with the money changers. Kennedy was slaughtered for interfering with the money changers. Let's return to the subject of your property and the tax sale for not paying property taxes. In this situation, under a standard deed, not common law deed, you are actually in default. Not because you understand the default or you like being in default, you are just in default of the tax payment. So they put your property up for sale. At the tax sale, Joe Doe, average American, bids on your property and gets it. Now, there was a procedure he must go through step by step to establish. He is required to give you another chance. You have 6 months and a day to pay off the default. If at this time you pay off the amount the county says you owe, plus penalties, interest, fines, etc., then your property is taken off default status and it is yours to continue to pay taxes on the next year. The brother's case. In my brother's case, he was never in default as he never made the promise in the common law deed to pay taxes. Therefore, the man who bought the property is moving against my brother through an attorney who is claiming that my brother never redeemed the property. His attorney had followed procedure by publishing the property tax notice in the newspaper for 3 printings. Now, they show up in court to get the court to declare default. After a default judgment, the attorney's client then has the right to the property. Now, my brother comes in and challenges this action. The problem is, the man who bought the property is trying to claim the property when in fact he is not the original creditor. He is not the person who said my brother was in default or that he owed a tax in the first place. Now, when my brother comes in and challenges the new buyer, the court rules that the new buyer is not required to produce any documents in support of his cause. The only documents they are required to produce are the documents related to procedure of foreclosure. Do you understand? There is no court case where the true creditor has to make an appearance. You cannot question or challenge the true creditor. When you do go to court, the person you are allowed to question is the person who bought the property. The buyer is not required to produce documents because the only ones who would be required to do so is the true creditor. Now, you are in the position of fighting yourself in court. This is a very clever way for the creditor to avoid the courts in order to settle the dispute for his claim against you. This is also a very clever way to avoid naming the true claimant, true plaintiff. The true plaintiff is the international bankster. The international banksters claim that they have a claim against my brother's property because my brother's property has been pledged by the state as collateral for the corporate debts under bankruptcy to the international bankers. Once my brother removed his property from their jurisdiction and venue by claiming back all his rights, titles, and interests, the only way they would be able to stand a chance would be for the original claimant, international banksters, to make an appearance through their attorney. Then for my brother to require their attorney to place in the record a statement identifying the true nature and cause for their actions. The courts and the attorneys have cleverly avoided this process. Remember, when you are dealing in bankruptcy, sleight of hand, lies, and deception, you have to protest to the head man in all of this action, just like the Watergate tapes. Everybody tried to protect Nixon, the head dog. It is the same in this bankruptcy scam. They all have to protect the international banksters. The proof that this is true is that, one, my brother is now in front of the Court of Appeals. The attorney for the people who bought the property has already said the buyers should not be required to present the authority establishing the state of Maryland's authority to tax property and to collect these taxes. This statement is the tip-off for how they are attempting to protect the international banksters. Since the international banksters never had to appear in court, they never were required to show where they got the right to pledge everybody's property into the United States corporate debt. The buyer's attorney says his client should not have to produce, and this court should not demand that he has to produce. Guess what? The court will agree with the buyer's attorney. They don't have to do it. They have to protect everybody's butt. The attorney never cited one case before 1953. The attorney put a lot of cases in his paperwork, but nothing is cited before 1938. Most of the cities Most of the cities are since 1963, when the state of Maryland passed the Uniform Commercial Code. All of the cities were in the 70s and 80s. A few cities were in the late 60s and one in the 50s. This lawyer knew what was going on. That's why, no matter what happens, someone in the court will stamp on the paperwork that this case cannot be cited in other cases. This case is not to be reported in the legal reports. The cover-up. There was a deal struck that if any person who doesn't have a lawyer to bring a case before the courts, and this person proves the fraud and speaks the truth about the fraud, the courts are compelled to not allow the case to be cited or published anywhere. The courts cannot afford to have the case freely available in the public archives. This would be evidence of the fraud. This is why you can't hire an attorney. An attorney is compelled to uphold the fraud. Trust me, I'm here to help you. I have the government's permission to practice. I'm a member of the bar. The attorney is there for one reason. That reason is to make sure the bankruptcy scam established by the corporate public policy of the corporate federal government is upheld. The lawyers will cite no cases for you that will go against the bankruptcy and corporate public policy. Whatever the lawyers do for you is a bunch of bull. The lawyers have to support the bankruptcy and public policy by supporting it, even at your expense. The lawyers can't go against the corporate federal government statutes implementing, protecting, and administrating the bankruptcy. For all cases cited, those in the U.S. Code or the state annotated code or any other source, you may be sure that they are only those selected cases that support the public policy of bankruptcy. The legal system has to work that way. After the last 50-plus years of cases, after cases having been decided based upon upholding the bankruptcy, how could the legal system possibly allow someone to come into court and put in the record substantial information and argument to prove fraud? Blood in the streets. Can you imagine how damaging it'd be if they allowed your case to be cited in another case, or if they allowed the public to examine a copy of your brief that discloses evidence of the fraud? This exposure would render null and void everything for which they have worked so hard. Wouldn't this exposure make the people mad? Wouldn't this exposure mean that there would be blood running in the streets, especially in the cities where the poor people have been really taken by this diabolical system? What they are concerned about is that the case never be cited. That goes against the bankruptcy for fear of exposing the bankruptcy, and the people will then pick up their guns and go after them. Mr. Sweet's case disappeared. There is a man, let's say his name is Sweet. He has been investigating the corporate government activities for over 12 years on a full-time basis. Now, let's look at Sweet's recent case. He won his case. He went into court and defended his common law lien on his property so as to be compatible with statutory law. The judge said, quote, "However, since you presented me with a lien on your property, I will stipulate that the county is the owner of your property with the provision that all liens be satisfied." Sweet was very happy about the judgment. Sweet doesn't care if the county is the owner of the property because the county can't take the property for the next 90 years. The county can't take the property away from him because of his common law lien on the property. Sweet is free to use it, rent it, whatever. If the county really wants the property, they have to satisfy the lien first. However, there was a problem regarding setting a precedent. Sweet went back a couple of weeks later and asked them to punch up his case number. Guess what? The case number had disappeared. The reason the case number disappeared is that after the judge ruled the county owned the property, subject to the lien, it became a case that goes against the corporate county bankruptcy public policy. Since Sweet placed a lien on his own property, he is the one who has to be paid off first, not the county. The county is now required to satisfy the lien before the county is allowed to take possession of the property. The property is probably not worth the price of the lien. This would not satisfy the true creditors, the international banksters. If the county pays Sweet off first, the city has to put on their records a $75,000 deficit. The true creditors wouldn't like that deficit. They certainly wouldn't like the fact that Sweet's clever maneuver had outfoxed the foxes. What if 100, 200, 1,000, or 10,000 people in your state would just put a common law lien on their property and then stop paying taxes, then cited Sweet's case? It would set a precedent. Let the county have the property as long as the judge makes the judgment subject to existing liens. In this situation, the county would end up holding all the property but could have no use of it. No rent, no taxes, no permits. All deficient. The bankster creditors certainly don't like this scenario. The banksters don't want any cases administered except through the application of bankruptcy procedure. The banksters want your rights, privileges, and due process strictly administered by and through the corporate courts under their corporate public policy, international bankruptcy procedure. The international banksters and their unregistered foreign agents don't want any evidence on the record showing how you can get out from under them. Any revenue collecting individual or agency, such as the courts, judges, lawyers, law enforcement officers, and tax collectors who are attempting to take money from you as a private American, must be registered as a foreign agent. If they are not duly registered and properly identified, they are involved in extortion, treason against private Americans. How sweet it is. As part of Sweet's maneuver, he filled out a financing statement using the UCC-1 form, whereby he put his wife and himself as debtors and creditors. Now the legal situation is switched. The UCC-1 financing record Sweet filed with the state shows Sweet and his wife as being the parties of interest recorded with the state, rather than the presumption that the international banksters are the parties of interest. There is an office within each corporate state Secretary of State that handles the Uniform Commercial Code UCC-1 claim forms. Since Sweet is listed on corporate state records as debtor and the creditor on his own property, his property can't be put up in any way for collateral against any debts claimed by the banksters. The reason is that the international banksters and their flunky agents now cannot prove that Sweet's property is debt property of the bank or the corporate county. The property cannot be put up against any debt claims until it is not encumbered by Sweet's lien.
BBSRadio.com.
All right. You said you wanted to be a lawyer, so you can find out what oath they're taking in secret behind closed doors in solemn preparation for the business of the court as judges and lawyers. Now you know the oath. The oath is simply to uphold the bankruptcy. If you want to be a lawyer and want to make a living as a lawyer, I can tell you this. They will weed you out at the very beginning if you don't bring in your paperwork under the bankruptcy procedures. If you try to defend your clients and try to help your clients, they will get rid of you. They will pull your license. So you have the money and time going to school under the guise of helping people, and you're wasting your time. Without that license, you can't go into a courtroom. I would think about this. Traffic citation. Regarding the UCC-1 form, you can also file it against your car. Wouldn't that be a kick in the tail if you went into court for a traffic citation where you had signed, without prejudice, UCC-1-207, and you had dishonored the traffic citation using the UCC in your procedure by having signed, without prejudice, and having gone home and sent in your dishonor of the presentment of the traffic citation? Now, let's say you're in front of the judge. The judge says, "What's this dishonor stuff all about?" The judge will not want any mention that the citation was issued under bankruptcy. He is afraid you will mention the bankruptcy issue. The reason you dishonored the traffic citation is that it was issued to you under bankruptcy corporate public policy. He won't get into that. When you get before the judge, you just state you have removed yourself from the bankruptcy. Tell him your auto is no longer pledged for collateral against the debt. He'll say, oh yeah, what are you talking about? That's when you hand him the UCC-1 form that you filed with the state. This UCC-1 form will show that you are the debtor and the creditor on your auto. Now what happens? The corporate county state can't collect on the traffic citation debt instrument. Why? Because not that you're the creditor on the ticket. If they collect a $100 fine, they have to pay you the amount of the fine. How sweet it is. You're the creditor, aren't you? People have done this. Of course, there is no record, no paper trail in such cases. It is not cited. The corporate banksters, agents, clerks, lawyers, judges, etc. take the information out of the records as soon as you can beat them at their own game. The Lawyer Guild connection, and this is winding up here, folks, so bear with me. Here's what I think happens in these cases. The American Bar Association is a franchise of the Lawyers Guild of Great Britain. The American Bar Association is not concerned primarily with what happens in any case on the local level. However, when a case leaves the local level, by that I mean the state court, city court, or the justice of the peace, or even the federal court, and goes to the appeals court, it would appear that the American Bar Association takes notice of the case. It would seem that the American Bar Association must have an agreement that any action brought on an appeal must be reviewed by the American Bar Association. If this is true, it would make sense. How else would the American Bar Association, a branch of the Lawyers Guild of Great Britain, which is the legal arm of the Rothschilds dynasty, be able to monitor and administrate the corporate bankruptcy? It would appear that the American Bar Association would be compelled to review all appeal cases and make certain any case brought under common law or the law that would expose the bankruptcy would be immediately stamped on the back that this case is not to be cited or published. I believe that this is the stamp origin and purpose of the stamp message in such cases. The Justice Department may be able to do that in Washington, D.C. I can't see where any judge or lawyer could have the authority to stamp or label the case as one not to be cited for future cases. I think that is an official stamp from the American Bar Association. The bankruptcy accounting system. Now, Joe Law student, if you're still attending classes and you have a good professor, ask him or her about just where the stamp comes from that you've seen on many cases. Just who put it on the paperwork and just who authorized the citation restriction. Just who is tampering with the law. There is one thing certain, the creditor and or his agents are watching these cases very carefully. The creditor and his agents must balance their books. When you think of the IRS, be aware that the IRS is an agent of the creditor, the corporate international banksters, one of the banksters' stateside agencies. The General Accounting Office is another agency they use for this country. This is where all the accounting goes to keep track of the debt. All the states have to send reports to Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. itself has to send reports to the GAO. Take a look at your state controller's annual report to the governor of your state. I found it in the library located in the city of the corporate state capital. Look under trust fund for each state subcorporation like the state courts, banks, education, etc. You will be amazed at the amount of money being pumped into the trust fund from the various corporate state departmental revenues. All revenue is referred to as taxes, fines, fees, licenses, etc. There are millions and billions of your hard-earned worthless Federal Reserve notes, dollars, being held in trust. This money is being siphoned off into the coffers of the international banksters while the corporate government officials are hounding you for more taxes. All this accounting is not so the people will know what is going on. The accounting reports are for the bankster creditors to keep tabs on just where their collections are coming from. The banksters want to know if the bankruptcy debt payments are coming in and just how much and from what sources. This accounting is the purpose behind M1, M2, M3, M4, and M5. All this accounting is closely monitored, maybe every day, but at least once a week. These M's are the reports of the amounts of money in circulation, the amount of debt out there, and the amount of credit out there. The floating of debt in the form of bonds. There are 5 different categories. This system had to come into existence in order for the creditors to be on top of the bankruptcy at all times. The system allows the creditors to figure out and know exactly what is going on in their domain. It all makes sense. Don't the banksters hire bill collectors? Creditors hire bill collectors to snoop around to see why you're not paying. They want to know how much you are going to pay so they can figure out how much will be coming in. How much will they collect? They want to know who will pay and who won't. The whole system is nothing but credit and debt. The World Credit Union. Here is what is going to very quickly happen internationally. All of the governments around the world are going to unite. They will create one big giant credit union for collecting the debt for the international banksters. We have allowed ourselves to get into this very sad situation, but that is the way it is. Welcome to the New World Order. For more information on this and other freedom issues, go to www.theawaregroup.com. And I shared that with you tonight so that you could consider all the things we've been talking about on other shows, and this is somewhat of a detailed explanation. I could add one thing, and that is that the aspect of what we know as the corporate United States is really operating as an international, implied, irrevocable charitable trust. And it's not even a real trust. In other words, it's implied. It's an implied trust. So it's an entity with which our corporate government does business and is really the entity calling the shots. All of what our government does is a two-party contract, and we only receive benefits out of that. We are not beneficiaries of that. Now, in these few examples here, we shared with you some ways that you can counter this. It's funny, and yet it applies here, is that, 3 people in the Cleveland, Ohio area last fall filed, a lawsuit against Deutsche Bank that, who had taken on 2,000 pieces of property. They had already raised 1,000 of those properties, the houses, and a judge ruled in favor of the plaintiffs who filed a lawsuit because these properties had illegally, through these mortgage pass-through accounts, which are part of the off-balance sheet derivative and hedge fund accounts that are in these illegal trusts. We mentioned that within this article, and I've mentioned this on other shows. Those trusts with the lawyers and the judges are illegal, and the only way to get away with it is by going after all the other people to pay. And all this money gets pooled. All the money from the courts gets pooled into these trusts. I hear in some cases that there are some judges that have gotten billions of dollars on retirement, or they were coerced into taking an early retirement. Now, that's not in every case, but certainly likely in the Chicago area, where the money laundering is very prevalent. And this is really what is at the bottom of the mortgage crisis, the banking crisis, the corporate bailout, and all of this. So when you're thinking about these things, think about this document. Certainly, I've had this for a short while, and I don't remember exactly how I came across it, but I'll give out that web address again. You can find it. It's called The Lawyer's Secret Oath. You can get it at www.theawaregroup.com. And with that, we got no calls this evening. Hope I didn't bore you to death. This is kind of heady stuff. After you've heard this a few times, you will begin to grasp it, and you'll actually be able to explain it to someone else. Basically, they're dealing with a bankruptcy that was declared under the administration of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on the heels of the Depression. And they have applied the Uniform Commercial Code to all business done in the country and with the states. And really, this goes around the planet. They are also not letting us know that the government is bankrupt. So when you consider things like the sayings that abundance cannot be created out of debt, at least for the one that's in debt, and you cannot create abundance by issuing debt instruments or promissory notes, that's a false kind of abundance. And yet that's the reality of what we have been living here in America for over 75 years. And it's something to really pay attention to. People are finding out that it's harder to get credit, and credit is just taking something that you don't have with the intention of paying more than what it's worth, and you're really not being given anything at all. It allows you to acquire items and things like that, things that break, things that deteriorate. In fact, you have the ability through the tax laws to depreciate those items 20% per annum if you're using them in a business. So it's a heady thing, and yet this is yet another explanation. Some of this material sounds like what has come forth from Mr. Lee Brobst, and I would hope that maybe next month I'm going to have Lee on the show. We'll be talking about this next week when we have Greg Pappas with us. In the meantime, we're out of time. Sorry for the interruptions. We had some communication problems. And join me tomorrow night when my special guest, again, will be scientist inventor Jim Murray. In the meantime, a special thanks to Don and Doug Newsom for making Evident Footprints possible, Seth Hendrick on the sound, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. I wish you a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.
I'm singer-songwriter Fremont John, and you're listening to BBSRadio.com.
Yeah.
You know how short time really
is.
And
I mean,
you don't have time for all the negativity and meaningless chit-chat that's out there on other talk radio stations. BBS Radio is your source to a world of inspiring information you can use.
You're
living on a timeline, and you need information you can use to help you live your dream. Request my song timeline right now. Buy my CDs at FremontJohn.com or CDBaby.com, and don't forget to friend me over on MySpace or Facebook. This is Fremont John. Thanks for listening.